have much choice.
"Pleased to meet you, I'm sure," he said, taking two of my fingers in his miniature fist and giving them a faint squeeze. "But we're closed." "It's my father, you see," I went on breathlessly. "Today's his birthday, and we wanted to, my sisters and I, that is, surprise him. He's expressed a great interest in something you have in your shop, and we'd hoped to—" "I'm sorry I'm so late, Mr. Pettibone, but I was folding bandages at the St. John's ambulance." I allowed my lower lip to tremble very slightly.
"And what is this, object?"
"A table," I blurted. It was the first thing that came to mind, and a jolly good thing I'd thought of it. There must be dozens of tables in a place like this, and I'd be able to have a good old snoop round while searching for the right one.
"Could you, describe it?"
"Yes," I said, "of course. It has four legs and a top." I could see that he was unconvinced. "It's for stamps, you see. Father's a philatelist, and he needs something he can spread his work on, under a lamp. His eyes are not quite what they used to be, and my sisters and I—" He was edging me towards the door.
"Oh, just a minute. I think that's it," I said, pointing to a rather sorry bit of furniture that was huddled in the gloom beneath an ormolu clock with plump-bellied pewter horses. By moving to touch it, I was 6 or 8 feet deeper into the shop. "Oh, no, this one's too dark. I thought it was mahogany. No, wait, it's this one over here."
I had plunged well towards the back of the shop and into the shadows. With Pettibone bearing down upon me like a wolf upon the fold, I realized that I was now cut off from the door and freedom.
"What are you playing at?"
he said, making a sudden grab for my arm. I leapt out of his reach. Suddenly, the situation had turned dangerous. But why? Was there something in the shop Pettibone didn't want me to see? Did he suspect that I was on to his shady antique dealings? Whatever the cause of his aggressiveness, I needed to act quickly. To my right, standing about a foot out from the wall, was a massive wardrobe. I slid behind it. For a while, at least, I was safe. He was too big to squeeze behind the thing. I might not be able to come out, but I'd have a moment to plan my next move. But then Pettibone was back with a broom. He shoved the bristles into my ribs and pushed. I stood my ground. Now he turned the broom around and began prodding at me furiously with the handle, like a man who has trapped a rat behind the kitchen cupboard.
"Ouch!" I cried out. "Stop! Stop it! You're hurting me!"
Actually, he wasn't, but I couldn't let him know that. I was able to slip far enough along the wall that I was beyond reach of his broom. As he came round the wardrobe to have a try from the other side, I slithered back to the far end. But I knew I was trapped. This game of cat and mouse could go on all day. Now the wardrobe had begun to move, its china casters squealing. Pettibone had put his shoulder to a corner and was shifting the thing out from the wall.
"Oh!" I shrieked. "You're crushing me!"
The wall of wood stopped moving, and there was a brief pause in his attack, during which I could hear him breathing heavily.
"Reginald!"
The voice, a woman's, cut through the shop like a falling icicle. I heard him mutter something.
"Reginald, come up here at once. Do you hear me?"
"Hello, upstairs," I shouted. "It's Flavia Deleuze." There was a silence, and then the voice said,
"Come up, Flavia. Reginald, bring the girl here."
It was as if she'd said, "Fetch." I slipped out from behind the wardrobe, rubbing my elbows, and shot him a reproachful look. His eyes strayed to a narrow staircase at the side of the shop, and before he could change his mind, I moved towards it. I could have made a break for the door, but I didn't. This could be my only chance at scouting out the place.
"In for a penny, in for a pound," as Mrs. Mallet was fond of saying.
I put my foot on the first step and began my slow trudge upstairs to whatever fate awaited me. the room at the top came as a complete surprise. Rather than the rabbit's warren of little cubicles I had imagined, the place was unexpectedly large. Obviously, all of the interior walls had been knocked out to form a spacious attic, which was the same size as the shop beneath. And what a contrast with the shop it was. There was no clutter up here. In fact, with one exception, the room was almost empty. In the middle of the floor stood a great square bed hung with white linen, and in it, propped up by a wall of pillows, was a woman whose features might well have been chiselled from a block of ice. There was a faint bluish or cyanotic tinge to her face and hands, which suggested, at first glance, that she might be the victim of either carbon monoxide or silver poisoning. But as I stared, I began to see that her complexion was coloured not by poison, but by artifice. Her skin was the colour of skim milk, her lips like those of her husband, I presumed that the parrot man was her husband, were painted a startling red, and, as if she were a leftover star from the silent cinema, her hair hung down around her face in a mass of silver ringlets. Only when I had taken in the details of the room and its occupant did I allow my attention to shift to the bed itself. An ebony four-poster, with its posts carved into the shape of black angels, each of them frozen into position like a sentry in his box at Buckingham Palace. Several mattresses must have been piled one atop the other to give the thing its height, and a set of wooden steps had been constructed at the bedside, like a ladder beside a haystack. Slowly, the icy apparition in the bed lifted a lorgnette to her eyes and regarded me coolly through its lenses. "Flavia de Luce, you say? One of Colonel de Luce's daughters? From Buckshaw?" I nodded. "Your sister Ophelia has performed for us at the Women's Institute, a remarkably gifted player." "I should have known. This landlocked iceberg was a friend of Feely's." Under any other circumstances, I'd have said something rude and stalked out of the room. But I thought better of it. The investigation of murder, I was beginning to learn, can demand great personal sacrifice. Actually, the woman's words were true. Feely was a first-rate pianist, but there was no sense going on and on about it. "Yes," I said, "she's quite talented." Until then, I had been unaware that Reginald was close behind me, standing on the stairs just one or two steps from the top.
"You may go, Reginald," the woman said,
and I turned to watch him descend in uncanny silence to the shop below.
"Now then," she said, "speak."
"I'm afraid I owe you and Mr. Pettibone an apology," I said. "I told him a lie."
"Which was?"
"That I'd come to buy a table for Father. What I really wanted was an opportunity to ask you about the Hobblers."
"The Hobblers?" she said with an awkward laugh. "Whatever makes you think I'd know anything about the Hobblers? They haven't existed since the days of powdered wigs."
In spite of her denial, I could see that my question had caught her off guard. Perhaps I could take advantage of her surprise. "I know that they were founded in the 17th century by Nicodemus Flitch, and that the Parlings at Buckshaw have played an important role in their history, what with baptisms and so forth."
I paused to see how this would be received.
"And what has this to do with me?" she asked, putting down the lorgnette and then picking it up again. "Oh, somebody mentioned that you belonged to that faith. I was talking to Miss Mountjoy and she..." True enough, I had been talking to Miss Mountjoy. As long as I didn't actually say that she'd told me, I'd be guilty of no great sin. Other than one of omission, perhaps. Feely was always going on and on about sins of commission and omission until your eyes were left spinning like fishing lures.
"Tilda Mountjoy," she said, after a long pause.
"I see. Tell me more."
Well, it's just that I've been making a few notes about Buckshaw's history, you know, and as I was going through some old papers in Father's library, I came across some quite early documents.
Documents? She demanded. What kind of documents?
She was rising to the bait. Her thoughts were written on her face as clearly as if they were tattooed on her cheeks.
Old papers relating to Nicodemus Flitch and the Hobblers, she was thinking. Now here's my opportunity to pull the rug out from under dear, dull as ditchwater old Tilda and her long-winded papers in the Hobblers Historical Society Journal. Former librarian be blowed. I'll show her what real research can bring to light.
And so forth. Oh, just odd bits and pieces, I said. Letters to one of my ancestors, Lucius de Luce, about this and that. Just a lot of names and dates, I added. Nothing terribly interesting, I'm afraid. This was the cherry on the icing, but I would pretend to brush it off as worthless. She was staring at me through her lenses like a bird watcher who has unexpectedly come upon the rare spotted crake. Now was the time to keep perfectly still. If my words hadn't primed the pump of curiosity, then nothing would. I could almost feel the heat of her gaze.
"There's more," she said. "What is it? You're not telling me the whole truth."
"Well," I blurted, "actually, I was thinking of asking if I might be allowed to convert to the Hobblers. We de Luces are not really Anglicans, you see. We've been Roman Catholics for ages. But Feely was telling me that the Hobblers were
non-conformists.
Yes, that's it, nonconformists. And I thought that, since I'm a nonconformist myself, well, why not join? There was a grain of truth in this. I remembered that one of my heroes, Joseph Priestley, the discoverer of oxygen, had once been the minister of a dissenting sect in Leeds, and if it was good enough for the esteemed Joseph...
"There's been a great deal of debate," she said reflectively, "about whether we're non-conformists or dissenters. What with our reconstitution in 17.
"Then you are a hobbler." She stared at me long and hard as if thinking.
"There are those," she said, "who work to preserve the foundations upon which their forefathers built. It is not always easy in this day and age."
"It doesn't matter to me," I said. "I'd give anything to be a hobbler." And in a way it was true. I had visions of myself limping cheerily along a country lane, my arms outstretched for balance, teetering like a tightrope walker as I veered crazily from hedge to hedge. "I'm a hobbler," I would shout out to everyone as I stumped past, as I was hobbling to St. Ives.
"Most interesting," the woman was saying as I came back to reality. "And is your father aware of your aspirations?"
"No," I said aghast. "Please don't tell him. Father is very set in his ways and..."
"I understand," she said. "We shall let it be our little secret then. No one but you and I shall know about any of this."
"Hey, presto!" "Oh, thank you," I breathed. "I knew you'd understand." As she rattled on about the Act of Toleration, the Five-Mile Act, the Countess of Huntingdon, and the Calvinist connection, I took the opportunity to look around the room. There wasn't much to see. The bed, of course, which, now that I had time to think about it, reminded me of the great bed of ware in the Victoria and Albert Museum. In a far corner near a window was a small table with an electric ring and a small kettle, a brown Betty teapot, a biscuit tin, and a single cup and saucer. Reginald Pettibone was evidently not in the habit of having breakfast with his wife.
"Would you care for a biscuit?" she asked.
"No, thank you," I said. "I don't use sugar."
It was a lie, but an excellent one.
"What an unusual child you are," she said, and with a wave of the hand towards the tin, she added, "Well then, perhaps you won't mind fetching one for me. I have no such scruples." I went to the window and reached for the biscuit tin. As I turned, I happened to glance outside, down into the fenced area behind the shop's back door. A rusty green van stood with its double doors open, and I knew instantly that it was the one I'd seen parked outside Willow Villa. As I watched, a powerful man in shirt sleeves stepped into view from somewhere below. It was the bulldog man, the man who had almost caught me in the coach house. Unless I was sadly mistaken, this would be Edward Sampson of Rye Road, East Finching, whose name I had found on the papers in the glove compartment. As I stood rooted to the spot, he reached into the back of the van and dragged out a couple of heavy objects. He turned and, perhaps feeling my eyes upon him, looked straight up at the window where I was standing. My immediate reaction was to shrink back, to step away from the glass, but I found that I could not. Some remote part of my mind had already spotted a detail that was only now leaking slowly into my consciousness, and I'm afraid I let out a gasp. The objects gripped in the hands of the bulldog man were Harriet's fire dogs, Sally Fox and Shoppo. Chapter 18. "What is it?" the woman asked. Her voice seemed to be coming from a very great distance. It's...
"Yes, dear, what is it?"
It was the deer that brought me snapping back. A deer, or dearie to me, is about as welcome as a bullet to the brain. I've had places reserved in the halfpenny seats of hell for people who address me in this way. But I bit my tongue. "It's... just that you have such a smashing view from your window," I said. "The river, Malplaquet Farm, all the way to East Finching and the hills beyond. One would never suspect, walking in the high street, that such a..." There was a floor-shaking crash from downstairs as some heavy object was dropped. A couple of muffled curses came drifting up through the floorboards. "Reginald!" the woman shouted, and there was an awkward silence in the depths.
"Men," she said, loudly enough to make herself heard downstairs. "Windmills on legs."
"I think I'd better go," I said. "They'll be expecting me at home."
"Very well, dear," she said. "Run along then, and don't forget about those letters. You may bring them whenever you're able."
I did not tell her what I was thinking, but rather gave a very small mock curtsy, then turned and made my way down the narrow stairs. At the bottom, I glanced towards the back of the shop. Reginald Pettibone and the owner of the van stood staring at me from the shadows. Neither of them moved or spoke, but I knew, in the way we females are supposed to know, that they had been talking about me. I turned my back on them and walked to the door, stopping only to write my initials casually in the dust that covered an ebony sideboard. I wasn't exactly afraid, but I knew how an animal trainer in a steel cage must feel when, for the first time, he turns his back on the fierce gaze of a pair of new tigers. Although she didn't say so, Gladys seemed happy to see me. I had parked her against a tree across the high street from Pettibone's shop. "There's dirty work at the crossroads," I told her. "I can feel it in my bones." I needed to get home at once to inspect the drawing-room hearth. The trees were making late afternoon shadows as I cycled through the Mulford gates and up the avenue of chestnuts. I'd soon be expected to put in an appearance at the dinner table, and I wasn't looking forward to it. As I opened the kitchen door, the sound of a Schubert sonata came floating to my ears. Success! I knew instantly that my psychic booby trap had been sprung. Feely always played Schubert when she was upset, and the opening of the piano sonata in B-flat major when she was especially distraught. I could almost follow her thoughts as the piano's notes went flying past my ears like birds from a forest fire. At first, there was a tightly controlled anger with threats of rolling thunder. How I loved the thunder. But when the full storm broke, Feely's fierce talent could still make me gasp with admiration.
I edged closer to the drawing room, the better to hear this remarkable outpouring of emotion. It was almost as good as reading her diary. I had to be careful, though, that she didn't catch sight of me until dinner, when Father would be there to save my hide. If Feely so much as suspected that I was responsible for the spirit message on her mirror, there would be buckets of blood on the carpet and entrails dangling from the chandeliers. The drawing room would have to wait. I did not realize how tired I had suddenly become until I was dragging myself up the stairs. It had been a long day, and it was far from over. Perhaps I thought I would have a nap. As I approached my laboratory, I came to an abrupt halt. The door was standing open. I peered round the corner, and there stood Porcelain, still wearing Fenella's black dress, toasting a slice of bread over a Bunsen burner. I could hardly believe my eyes. "Cheero," she said, looking up. "Would you like some toast?" As if she hadn't just recently accused me of bashing in her grandmother's brains. "How did you get in?" "I used your key," she said, pointing. "It was still inserted in the lock. I watched you hide it in the hollow bedpost." It was true. I had long before discovered Uncle Tar's secret hiding place for keys and other things he wanted to keep to himself. My bedroom had once been his, and over time all, or most of its secrets, had been revealed. "You've got your bloody nerve," I said. The thought of someone invading my laboratory made my skin crawl, as if an army of red ants were swarming up my arms, fanning out across my shoulders and up the back of my neck. "I'm sorry, Flavia," she said. "I know it wasn't you that attacked Fenella. I can't have been thinking straight. I was confused. I was tired. I came back to apologize." "Then you'd better get at it," I said. I was not going to be mollified. Wasn't that the term Daffy had used when she'd said the same thing to me? Mollified, with just a couple of token words. There are times when I'm sorry is simply not enough. "I'm sorry," she said. "I really am. It's all so upsetting. It's just too much." Suddenly she was in tears. "First there was Fenella. Now they won't let me see her, you know. They've got a constable in a chair watching the door to her room. Then there was that awful business of the man we found hanging from the fountain." "Brookie Harewood," I said. I'd almost forgotten about Brookie. "And now this latest body they've dug up in. Would you call it the Parlings?" "What? Another body? In the Parlings?" "It's all too much," she said, wiping her nose on her forearm. "I'm going back to London." Before I could say another word, she dug into a pocket and pulled out a £5 note. "Here," she said, prying open my fingers and pressing them closed upon the banknote. "That's to feed Gry until Finella's discharged from hospital, and—" She looked straight into my eyes, still gripping my hand. Her lips were trembling. "If she doesn't recover, he's yours. The caravan, too. I came here to tell you I'm sorry, and I've done it. Now I'm leaving."
"Wait, what did you say about another body?"
"Ask your inspector friend," she said, and turned towards the door. I made a lunge for the key and slammed the door shut. We tussled for the doorknob, but I managed to grab the key, jam it into the inside lock, and give it a frantic twist.
"Hand it over. Let me out."
"No," I said. "Not until you tell me what you saw in the Parlings."
"Come off it, Flavia. I'm not playing games."
"Nor am I," I told her, crossing my arms. As I knew she would, she made a sudden snatch at the key. It was an old trick often used by Daffy and Feely, and I suppose I ought to have been grateful for having learned it from them. Being ready for the next move, I was able to hold the key out, at arm's length, away from her. And then she gave up, just like that. I could see it in her eyes. She brushed her hair away from her face and walked back to one of the laboratory tables, where she splayed her fingers out upon its surface as if to keep from toppling over. I went back to the caravan to pick up my things, she said,
slowly and deliberately. And the police were there again. They wouldn't let me anywhere near it. They were lifting something out of a hole in the ground.
Lifting what?
She was staring at me with something that might have been defiance.
Believe me, it wasn't gold.
Tell me, for God's sake, Flavia.
I waved the key at her.
Tell me.
It was a body, wrapped in a carpet or something, not very big. A child, I think. I only saw one of the feet,
or what was left of it.
A bundle of old green bones, she added. She clapped her hand across her mouth and her shoulders heaved. I waited patiently for more, but if there were any further interesting details, Porcelain was keeping them to herself. We stared at each other for what seemed like a very long time.
Fenella was right, she said at last. There is a darkness here.
I held out the key and she lifted it from my open palm with two fingers as if it, or I, were contaminated. Without a word, she unlocked the door and let herself out.
What was I supposed to feel, I wondered.
To be perfectly honest, I think I had been looking forward to having Porcelain dog my every step as I went about investigating the attack upon Fenella and the murder of Brookie Harewood. I had even thought of ways of giving her the slip, if necessary, as I traipsed about the village, digging up information.
And perhaps I had too much anticipated sitting her down and patiently explaining the trail of clues and the way in which they pointed to the culprit, or culprits. But now, by walking out, she had deprived me of all that. I was alone again. As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. No one to talk to but myself.
Except Dogger, of course.
Dogger was sitting in the last shaft of sunlight in the garden. He had brought an old wooden chair from the greenhouse and, perched upon the edge of its seat, was hammering nails into the tin stripping that sealed the wooden tea chest that lay before him in the grass. I lowered myself into the wheelbarrow that was standing nearby.
They found another body, I said, at the Parlings.
Dogger nodded. I believe that saw Miss Flavia.
It's the ball baby, isn't it?
Dogger nodded again and put down the hammer.
I should be surprised if it weren't.
Did you hear about it from Mrs. Mallet?
Although I knew it was not a done thing to inquire of one servant about another, there was no other way. I couldn't just ring up Inspector Hewitt and pump him for the details.
No, he said, preparing to drive home another nail. Miss Porcelain told me.
Porcelain? I said, gesturing up towards the east wing, towards my bedroom window. You knew about Porcelain, that she was staying here?
Yes, Dogger said, and left it at that.
After a few seconds I relaxed, and there fell between us another one of those luxurious silences that is part of most conversations with Dogger. Silences so long and profound and golden that it seems irreverent to break them. Dogger rotated the tea chest and began to apply stripping to another edge.
You have very fine hands, I said at last. They look as if they belong to a concert pianist.
Dogger put down the hammer and examined both sides of each hand as if he had never seen them before.
I can assure you that they are my own, he said.
This time, there could be no doubt about it. Dogger had made a joke. But rather than laughing condescendingly, I did the right thing and nodded wisely, as if I knew it all along. I was learning that among friends, a smile can be better than a belly laugh.
Dogger, I said, there's something I need to know. It's about nosebleeds.
I had the impression that he looked at me sharply, even though he hadn't.
Are you having nosebleeds, Miss Flavia?
No, I said. No, not at all. It's no one here at Buckshaw.
Actually, it's Miss Mountjoy at Willow Villa. And I described to him what I had seen in that dank kitchen.
Ah, Dogger said, and then fell silent.
After a time, he spoke again, slowly, as if his words were being retrieved, one by one, from some deep well.
Recurrent nosebleeds. Epitaxis. May have many causes.
Such as, I urged.
Genetic predisposition, he said. Hypertension or high blood pressure. Pregnancy, dengue or breakbone fever. Nasopharyngeal cancer, adrenal tumour, scurvy. Certain diseases of the elderly, such as hardening of the arteries. It may also be symptomatic of arsenic poisoning.
Of course, I knew that. How could I have forgotten?
However, Dogger went on, from what you've told me, it is none of these. Miss Mountjoy's nosebleeds are most likely brought on by the excessive consumption of cod liver oil.
Cod liver oil?
I must have said it aloud. I expect she takes it for her arthritis, Dogger said, and went back to his hammering.
Gack, I said, making a face. I hate the smell of the stuff.
But Dogger was not to be drawn out.
Isn't it odd, I ploughed on, how nature puts the same pong in the liver of a fish as it does in a weed like the stinking goosefoot and in the willow that grows by the water.
Stinking goosefoot, Dogger said, looking up in puzzlement. And then, ah, yes, of course. The methylamines. I've forgotten about the methylamines. And then,
yes, I said, too quickly and too eagerly. There were times when Dogger's memory, having been primed, worked beautifully for a short time, like the vicar's battered old Oxford, which ran well only in the rain. I crossed my fingers and my ankles and waited, biting my tongue. Dogger removed his hat and stared into it as if the memory were hidden in its lining. He frowned, wiped his brow on his forearm, and went on hesitantly. I believe there were several cases reported in the Lancet in the last century in which a patient was recorded as exuding a fishy smell.
Perhaps he was a fisherman, I suggested. Dogger shook his head. In neither case was the patient a fisherman, and neither had been known to be in contact with fish. Even after bathing, the piscine odour returned, often following a meal.
Of fish?
Dogger ignored me. There was, of course, the tale in the Bhagavad Gita of the princess who exuded a fishy odour.
Yes, I said, settling back as if to hear a fairy tale.
Somewhere in the distance, a harvesting machine clattered away softly at its work, and the sun shone down.
What a perfect day it was, I thought.
But wait, I said. What if his body were producing trimethylamine? This was such an exciting thought that I sprang out of the wheelbarrow.
It would not be unheard of, Dogger said thoughtfully.
Shakespeare might have been thinking of just such a complaint. What have we here? A man or a fish? Dead or alive? A fish. He smells like a fish, a very ancient and fish-like smell.
A chill ran up my spine. Dogger had slipped into the loud and confident voice of an actor who has delivered these lines many and many a time before.
The Tempest, he said quietly. Act 2, scene 2, if I'm not mistaken. Trinculo, you'll recall, is speaking of Caliban.
Where do you dig up these things? I asked in admiration.
On the wireless, Dogger said. We listened to it some weeks ago.
It was true. At Buckshaw, Thursday evenings were devoted to compulsory wireless listening, and we had recently been made to sit through an adaptation of The Tempest without fidgeting. Other than the marvellous sound effects of the storm, I didn't remember much about the play, but obviously Dogger did.
"Is there a name for this fishy condition?" I asked.
"Not to the best of my knowledge," he said. "It is exceedingly rare, I believe."
"Go on," I said eagerly.
But when I looked up at Dogger, the light in his eyes had gone out. He sat staring at his hat, which he held clutched in his trembling hands as if he had never seen it before. "I believe I'll go to my room now," he said, getting slowly to his feet.
"It's all right," I said. "I think I will, too. A nice nap before dinner will do both of us good."
But I'm not sure that Dogger heard me. He was already shambling off towards the kitchen door. When he was gone, I turned my attention to the wooden tea-chest he had been nailing shut. In one corner was pasted a paper label, upon which was written in ink, "This side up, contents, silver cutlery, Deluce, Buckshaw."
Cutlery? Had Dogger packed the Mumpeters in this crate? Mother and Father Mumpeter, little Grindlestick and her silver sisters? Is that why he'd been polishing them? Why on earth would he do such a thing? The Mumpeters were my childhood playthings, and the very thought of anyone. But hadn't Brookie Harewood been murdered with one of the pieces from this set? What if the police...
I walked round to the far side of the crate, the side that Dogger had turned away from me as I approached. As I read the words that were stenciled in awful black letters on the boards, something vile and sour rose up in my throat. "Sotheby's, New Bond Street, London, WC," it said. Father was sending away the family silver to be auctioned. Chapter 19. Dinner was a grim affair. The worst of it was that Father had come to the table without the London philatelist. Instead of reading, he insisted upon solicitously passing me the peas and asking,
"Did you have a nice day today, Flavia?"
It almost broke my heart. Although Father had spoken several times of his financial troubles, they had never seemed threatening. No more than a distant shadow, really, like war or death. You knew it was there, but you didn't spend all day fretting about it. But now, with the Mumpeters nailed up inside a crate, ready to be taken to the train for London and pored over by strangers at the auction rooms, the reality of Father's predicament had hit home with the force of a typhoon. And Father, the dear man, was trying to shield us from the reality by making bright table chatter. I could feel the tears welling up in my eyes, but I dared not give in to them. It was fortunate that Daffy, who sat across from me, did not even want to look up from her book. To my left, at the far end of the table, Feely sat staring down into her lap, her face pale, her colourless lips pressed together into a tight, thin line. The dark circles under her eyes were like bruises, and her hair was lank and lifeless. The only word to describe her was blighted. My chemical wizardry had worked. The proof of it was the fact that Feely was wearing her spectacles, which told me, without a doubt, that she had spent the day staring in horror at the spirit message that had materialized upon her looking-glass. In spite of her occasional cruelty, or perhaps because of it, Feely was a pious sort, whose time was devoted to making bargains with this saint or that about the clarity of her complexion, or the way in which a random beam of sunlight would strike her golden hair as she knelt at the altar for communion. Where I generally believed in chemistry and the happy dance of the atom, Feely believed in the supernatural, and it was that belief I had taken advantage of. But what had I done? I hadn't counted on such utter devastation. Part of my brain was telling me to leap up and run to her, to throw my arms around her neck and tell her that it was only French chalk and not God that had caused her misery. And then we would laugh together as we used to in the olden days. But I couldn't. If I did, I should have to confess to my prank in front of Father, and I wanted to spare him any further grief. Besides, Feely would more than likely stab me to death with whatever came to hand, snow-white tablecloth or not. Which made me think of Brookie Harewood. How odd! There hadn't been a word at the dinner table about murder. Or was it now murders, plural? It was then, I think, that I noticed the cutlery. Instead of our usual silver utensils, I realized that each of our places had been set with the yellow-handled knives and forks that were kept in the kitchen for the use of the servants. I could contain it no longer. I scraped my chair back from the table, mumbled something about being excused, and fled. By the time I reached the foyer, my tears were splashing about me like rain on the black and white checkerboard of the tiles. I threw myself onto the bed and buried my face in the pillow. How could revenge hurt so keenly? It didn't make any sense. It simply didn't. Revenge was supposed to be sweet, and so was victory. As I lay there, flattened by misery, I heard the unmistakable sound of Father's leather-soled shoes outside in the hall. I could hardly believe my ears. Father, in the east wing? This was the first time since I had moved into it that he had set foot in this part of the house. Father came slowly into the room, shuffling a little, and I heard him pause. A moment later, I felt the bed sink a little as he sat down beside me. I kept my face pressed tightly into the pillow. After what seemed like a very long time, I felt his hand gently touching my head, but only for a moment. He did not stroke my hair, nor did he speak, and I was glad he didn't. His silence spared both of us the embarrassment of not knowing what to say. And then he was gone, as quietly as he had come, and I slept. In the morning, the world seemed a different place. I whistled in my bath. I even remembered to scrub my elbows. It had come to me in the night, as if in a dream, that I must apologize to Feely. It was as simple as that. In the first place, it would disarm her. In the second place, it would impress Father if Feely had told him what I had done. And finally, it would make me feel all warm and self-righteous about doing the decent thing. Besides, if I played my cards right, I could also pump Feely for information about Vinetta Harewood. I would not, of course, tell her about the lost portrait of Harriet. It was the perfect solution. There's nothing as beautiful as the sound of a piano in the next room. A little distance gives the instrument a heart. At least to my sensitive hearing, it does. As I stood outside the drawing-room door, Feely was practicing something by Rameau, Les Sauvages, I think it was called. It sometimes made me think of a moonlight glade. The Parlings, perhaps, with a tribe of devils dancing in a circle like maniacs. So much more pleasing, I thought, than that sleepy old thing on the same topic by Beethoven. I straightened my back and squared my shoulders. Feely was always telling me to square my shoulders, and I thought she'd be happy to see that I'd remembered. The instant I opened the door, the music stopped and Feely looked up from the keyboard. She was learning to play without her spectacles, and she was not wearing them now. I couldn't help noticing how beautiful she looked. Her eyes, which I had expected to be like a pair of open coal holes, shone with a cold blue brilliance in the morning light. It was like being glared at by Father. "Yes," she said. "I've come to say I'm sorry," I told her.
"Then do so."
"I just did, Feely."
"No, you didn't. You made a statement of fact. You stated that you had come to say you're sorry. You may begin."
This was going to be more humiliating than I thought.
I'm sorry, I said, for writing on your mirror.
Yes?
I swallowed and went on. It was a mean and thoughtless trick.
It was indeed, you odious little worm.
She got up from the piano bench and came towards me, menacingly, I thought. I shrank back a little.
Of course I knew at once that it was you. Deuteronomy, the boils of Egypt, the emeralds, the scurvy and the itch. It had Flavia Deluce written all over it. You might just as well have signed the thing, like a painting.
That's not true, Feely. You were devastated. I saw the circles under your eyes at dinner.
Feely threw her head back and laughed.
Make up, she crowed. French chalk? Two can play at that game, you stupid moke. A bit of French chalk and a pinch of ashes from the grate. It took me all afternoon to get it just the right shade. You should have seen your face. Daffy said she almost had an accident trying not to laugh.
My face began to burn.
Didn't you, Daff?
There was the sound of a wet snicker behind me, and I spun round to find Daffy coming through the doorway, blocking my route of escape.
It was a mean and thoughtless trick, she said, imitating me in a grating falsetto parrot voice. She had been eavesdropping on my apology from outside in the hallway.
But now, rather than flying at her in fury, as I might have done even yesterday, I gathered up every last scrap of inner strength and attacked her with a new and untried tool. Clear, cold, calm.
Who is Hilda Muir?
I asked, and Daffy stopped moving instantly, as if she had been frozen in a snapshot. The appeal to a superior knowledge, and it worked. By coming to one of my sisters in humility and keeping my temper with the other, I had gained in just a few minutes not one, but two new weapons.
What?
Hilda Muir. She's something to do with the Parlings.
Hilda Muir, Fenella had said when we'd first spotted Mrs. Bull in the gully. Hilda Muir, she'd said it again when I brought the elder branches to the caravan. Now we are all dead.
Who is Hilda Muir? I asked again in my new and maddeningly calm voice.
Hilda Muir? The Parlings? You must mean the Hilda Muir. She's not a person, you idiot. She's the spirit of the elder branches. She comes to punish people who cut her branches without first asking permission. You didn't cut any elder branches, did you?
This with another wet snicker. Daffy must have seen the effect her words had on me.
I truly hope you didn't. They sometimes plant them on a grave to indicate whether the dead person is happy in the next world. If the elder grows, all's well. If not...
The next world, I thought. Hadn't Porcelain watched the police pull a baby's body from the very spot, or very near it, that I had cut the elder for firewood?
The Hilda Muir's a pixie, Daffy went on. Don't you remember what we told you about the pixies? For heaven's sake, Flavia, it was only a couple of days ago. The pixies are the old ones, those horrid creatures who stole Harriet's precious baby and left you in its place.
My mind was an inferno. I could feel the anger rushing back like the Red Sea after the passage of the Israelites.
I hope you didn't cut elder from someone's grave, she went on, because if you did...
Thank you, Daffy, I said. You've been most informative. Without another word, I brushed past her and stalked out of the drawing room. With the mocking laughter of my darling sister still ringing in my ears, I fled down the echoing hall. Chapter 20. In the laboratory, I locked the door and waited to see what my hands were going to do. It was always like this. If I just relaxed and tried not to think too hard, the great god chemistry would guide me. After a time, although I'm not sure why, I reached for three bottles and placed them on the bench. Using a pipette, I measured half an ounce of a clear liquid from the first of these into a calibrated test tube.
From the second bottle, I measured 3 ounces of another fluid into a small flask. I watched in fascination as I combined the 2 clear fluids with several ounces of distilled water, and before my eyes a reddish colour appeared. Presto, change-o, aqua regia, royal water. The ancient alchemists gave it that name because it is capable of dissolving gold, which they considered to be the king of metals. I have to admit that manufacturing the stuff myself never fails to excite me. Actually, aqua regia is more orange than red, the precise colour of pomegranates, if I remember correctly. Yes, pomegranates, that was it. I had once seen these exotic fruits in a shop window in the high street. Mr. Hughes, the greengrocer, had imported the things on a trial basis, but they had remained in his shop window until they blackened and caved in upon themselves like rotted puffballs.
"Bishop's Lacey bin't ready for pomegranates yet," he had told Mrs. Mullet. "We don't deserve 'em."
I had always marvelled at the way in which 3 clear liquids, nitric acid, hydrochloric acid, and water, when combined, could produce, as if by magic, colour. And not just any colour, but the colour of a flaming sunset. The swirling shades of orange in the glass seemed to illustrate perfectly the thoughts that were swarming round and round, mixing in my mind. It was all so confoundedly complicated. The attack upon Fenella, the gruesome death of Brookie Harewood, the sudden appearance and equally sudden disappearance of Porcelain, Harriet's fire dogs turning up in not one, but 3 different locations. The strange antiques shop of the abominable Pettibones, Miss Mountjoy and the Hobblers, Vanetta Harewood's long-lost portrait of Harriet, and underneath it all, like the rumble of a stuck organ pipe, the constant low drone of Father's looming bankruptcy. It was enough to make an archangel spit. In its container, the aqua regia was growing darker by the minute, as if it too were waiting impatiently for answers. And suddenly, I saw the way. Lighting a Bunsen burner, I set it beneath the flask. I would warm the acid gently before proceeding with the next step. From a cupboard, I took down a small wooden box upon the end of which Uncle Tar had penciled the word platinum and slid open the lid. Inside were perhaps 12 flat squares of the silvery grey mineral, none larger than an adult's fingernail. I selected a piece that weighed perhaps 1/4 ounce. When the aqua regia had reached the proper temperature, I picked up the bit of platinum with a pair of tweezers and held it above the mouth of the flask. Aside from the hiss of the gas, the laboratory was so quiet that I actually heard the tiny plop as I let the platinum drop into the fluid. For a moment, nothing happened. But now the liquid in the flask was a darkening red, and then the platinum began to writhe. This was the part I liked best. As if in agony, the bit of metal crept towards the glass wall of the flask, trying to escape the acids that were consuming it. And suddenly, poof, the platinum was gone. I could almost hear the aqua regia licking its lips. "More, please." It wasn't that the platinum had not put up a noble fight, because it had. The important thing, I reminded myself, was this. Platinum cannot be dissolved by any one acid. No, platinum could not be dissolved by nitric acid alone, and it merely laughed a jolly ha-ha at hydrochloric acid. Only when the 2 combined could platinum be broken down. There was a lesson here, 2 lessons in fact. The first was this. I was the platinum. It was going to take more than a single opponent to overcome Flavia Sabina Deluce. What was left in the flask was bichloride of platinum, which in itself would be useful to test, in some future experiment perhaps, for the presence of either nicotine or potassium. More to the point, though, was the fact that although the platinum chip had vanished, something new had been formed, something with a whole new set of capabilities. And then, quite suddenly, I caught a glimpse of my face reflected in the glassware, watching wide-eyed as the somewhat cloudy liquid in the flask, shifting uneasily, took on, perhaps, a tinge of sickly yellow, as if in the drifting mists of a gypsy's crystal ball. I knew then what I had to do.
"Aha, Flavia," the vicar said. "We missed you at church on Sunday."
"Sorry, vicar," I told him. "I'm afraid I rather overdid myself on Saturday, what with the fete and so forth." Since good works do not generally require trumpeting, I did not feel it necessary to mention the assistance I had offered to Fenella. As it turned out, I was right to hold my tongue, because the vicar quickly brought up the subject himself.
"Yes," he said. "Your father tells me you were allowed rather a luxurious Sabbath lion."
"Really, Flavia, it was most kind of you to play the Good Samaritan, as it were. Most kind." "It was nothing," I said, with becoming modesty. "I was happy to help."
The vicar got to his feet and stretched. He had been snipping away with a pair of kitchen scissors at the tufts of grass growing round the wooden legs of the St. Tancred signboard.
"God's work takes many strange forms," he said, when he saw me grinning at his handiwork.
"I visited the poor soul in hospital," he went on, "directly after morning prayer."
"You spoke to her?" I asked, astonished.
"Oh dear, no, nothing like that. I'm sure she wasn't even aware of my presence. Nurse Dugan told me that she hadn't regained consciousness, the gypsy woman, of course, not Nurse Dugan, and that she, the gypsy woman, I mean, had spent a restless night, crying out every now and then about something that was hidden. The poor thing was delirious, of course."
"Something hidden?
What could Fenella have meant?"
It was true that she had mentioned to me the woman whose fortune she had told just before mine, something about something that was buried in the past. But would that count as hidden? It was worth a try.
"It's too bad, isn't it?" I said, shaking my head. "Hers was the most popular pitch at the fete, until the tent caught fire, that is. She was telling me how startled someone was, the person who went in just before me, I believe, when she happened to guess correctly something about her past."
Had a little cloud drifted across the vicar's face?
"Her past? Oh, I should hardly think so. The person whose fortune was told immediately before yours was Mrs. Bull."
"Mrs. Bull?
Well, I'll be blowed. I'd have been willing to take an oath that Mrs. Bull's first encounter with Fenella in several years had taken place in my presence on Saturday in the gully, after the fete."
"Are you sure?" I asked.
"Quite sure," the vicar said. "I was standing near the coconut pitch talking to Ted Sampson when Mrs. Bull asked me to keep an eye on her tots for a few minutes. 'I shan't be long, vicar,' she said, 'but I must have my fortune read. Make sure there are no more of these little blighters in my future.' She was joking, of course, but still, it seemed a very odd thing to say. Under the circumstances..." The vicar reddened. "Oh dear, I fear I've been indiscreet. You must forget my words at once."
"Don't worry, vicar," I told him. "I won't say a word."
I went through the motions of sewing my lips shut with a needle and a very long piece of thread. The vicar winced at my grimaces.
"Besides," I said, "it's not the same as if the bulls were your parishioners."